one into the night. Deep into right. Way out of here.
Swung on.
Bit crushed.
And the Phillies are going to lead it.
Harper, the swing of his life.
The 0-2 pitch. Swing and a miss. Struck him out.
From WHYY, welcome to your Friday edition of Hittin' Season, a Philadelphia Phillies podcast. I'm Justin Clue, and I write for Baseball Prospectus. I'm the author of Summer of the Cheap Wieners, what the 1941 Phillies were doing while Joe DiMaggio was making history. Available now. With me is Liz Rocher, the editor of Sabres Baseball Research Journal. Hello, Liz.
Hello, Justin. Hello. What a series.
I'd like to start by reading part of the opening of Spencer Nussbaum's write-up on the Phillies and Nationals series. He covers the Nationals for The Athletic. And so he was writing about the Nationals. He was writing about their bullpen. But I'm just going to read the opening of this story.
I'm so excited.
The Washington Nationals were a strike away from beating the Philadelphia Phillies on Tuesday and blew it. They were a strike away on Wednesday and blew it again. They held a 5-0 lead on Thursday, allowed the Phillies to tie it up entering the ninth, then listened as a crowd of shirtless men throughout the upper deck and right field interrupted a perfect summer night with a sound that this organization will not soon forget. Those who stood in the section yelled and waved their shirts over their heads while chanting USA at random intervals. Those who migrated over from a crowd of 28,919 hurled obscenities, as they had all series, including at Trey Turner, who won a ring in Washington and had never received anything but cheers at this stadium. And then, in the top of the ninth, in the middle of the most important at-bat of the season, which for the Nats was also the most important at-bat of the last 5 years, the horde chanted, F Bryce Harper. In the middle, now we'll just pause here and say, boy, people just don't learn that when you're trying to starve out Bryce Harper, the last thing you want to do is feed him.
Yep.
In the middle of the chant, Harper whipped his barrel through the zone and hit the go-ahead home run off a reliever, making the MLB minimum salary. As the Nationals' former golden child rounded first, he extended a finger. He said it was obviously his ring finger and pointed it toward the shirtless crowd that filled the section. And as he crossed home plate, one of five Phillies to do so in the ninth inning of a 10-5 win over the Nationals, he held up the digit again. Boy, oh boy, Liz, what a series. What a, for every reason, what a series. You can go ahead and just, you know, we're going to walk through all four of these games, but you made it over to the last game of this series last night on Thursday. Just want to give us a quick rundown of what the vibes were by that point, because at that point, the Nationals had already lost two games with two outs and two strikes on a Phillies batter in the ninth.
It was an interesting game. Anytime I go to a Nationals game, it's hard to tell how many Phillies fans are there because the colors are both red. And when the Phillies do something good, you hear a big, big cheer. And when the Nationals do something good, you hear a slightly comparable cheer. It's hard to tell. So the vibes were a little testy. Like, they were giving out, there was a souvenir for the night. It was a really ugly Nationals soccer jersey. Everyone was wearing them. It was just it felt weird to start. And then Christopher Sanchez was on the mound and everyone started to feel better. It was like when the sixth or seventh inning, when the big inning with all the walks happened, you could feel the air going out of the stadium and people are like, no, not again. There was a couple next to me just absolutely losing their mind. They could not believe that the Nationals were doing this again. It was hilarious.
One thing that you noticed at the stadium or just reading the coverage about this series or listening to clips from the Nationals broadcast is that entering this series, the Nationals had a winning record. And that meant, I learned, that meant that they view themselves as, like, on the same level as Phillies. This was very much about for them proving, like, oh, no, we're kind of like an upstart right. National League wildcard team, but also, like, we can beat these good teams. And, they, like I said, they had a winning record. They've clearly done a lot of things well. James Wood is one of those players where, like, put him in another uniform and I'm clapping for him all day. Like, put him in like a Mariners uniform and I'm like, that guy is awesome.
I'd rather that, please.
But I think we saw for four straight games, at least three, that the Nationals just have like an empty pillowcase for a pitching staff. And it's just, it's not going to be anything that sustains them into October. Not this year. Not this year. But it was very funny because the Nationals are always that way with the Phillies. And this is sort of a resurgence of that little brother energy that they just have toward the Phillies. And it's really been funny since that has become a thing, you know, long before this, but even before the famous tweet about how easy it is to beat the Phillies and their horrible record against the Phillies ever since that tweet, even before that. Phillies have had, a little brother relationship with lots of teams. Philadelphia has that kind of dynamic with New York and that, like, oh, we're a big city. Like, blah, blah. It's just funny that this other team kind of popped up behind them in as time went on. And now the Phillies have a little brother team as well. And it's a hilarious dynamic to see them show up. Like, the Phillies come to Washington for a series like this. The Nationals are like, well, we have something to, we're really good too, and we can beat you. Blah, blah. And then this happens. And you're like, yeah,
we're,
I mean, someday, someday there are going to be a playoff team again. This is not that day. So let's go back to game one and just walk through. We'll do a quick rundown of these games. John Stolness, of course, talked about these games more in full with our resident expert on the Nationals, Ethan Stolness, John's son. So that was at the midweek episode. We won't go through all of these in great detail, but I feel like we got to at least, you got to go through all four games because they tell a complete story. So game one, the Phillies go with that bullpen game in Washington. Tim Mays is the opener. Alan Ranhel, Seth Johnson, Chase Shugart. Kind of what I'd call close to the bottom of the Phillies pitching barrel as far as who you can throw out there. This also has a happy ending as far as the series goes, but this was the game the Phillies lost, and they lost it for a reason. They allowed just enough Washington offense to lose the game, and the Phillies offense didn't really show up for this one. Marsh hit a homer, as he just does now. That's just a thing that he
does.
Bryce Harper had a couple of hits in that one, but the Phillies lose game one 4-1. And like I said, for the Phillies, this series was about beating the Nationals. You learned from game one for the Nationals. The game was about proving that they're really a contender. And this first game, in which their starter Foster Griffin threw 7 1/3 innings, had 9 strikeouts against the Phillies. I mean, that did a lot for that belief. According to Byron Kerr of MLB.com, Griffin said after the game, "I feel like we've played a lot of playoff teams, and we're up there above 500, and we're pushing for a wild card spot." Getting pretty close to saying, like, we're up there with the best. They know they don't have the nerve to claim that yet, but they were trying to claim, like, yeah, we're in there, we're in the mix. He said, "You never know what can happen. I know I'm really impressed with this team as a whole. We're not backing down to anybody." You know, all the normal cliches of a team that's trying to prove, like, we're going to be the upstart, little puppy that's nipping at the heels of these other teams that are clearly better, but who we might be able to beat. So after that game one loss, Liz, did you feel like the Phillies had kind of come in with the wrong vibes to Washington? Or did you feel like, it's a 4-game series?
For me, that was just sort of a wash with the bullpen-ness of it all. Like, Ranhel did pretty good. I think he went, 4 scoreless or something, which is nice to see. The Phillies are always looking for, a long reliever type guy. But I just chalked it up to a bad game, bullpen game. It wasn't even all that bad. It was just not enough offense because, for your fifth starter to allow, 4 runs? Not too bad. You just have to score more than that, and they did not.
Yeah, the Nationals, I believe, did not score less than 4 runs in any of these games. And the Phillies only lost one of them. So clearly a beatable amount of offense.
Real funny.
That was, there was all the fallout of Andrew Painter and that decision to send him down and Ranhel being, the arm they're calling up to deal with that. But also this kind of stitched together bullpen monster is what happens when you don't have a sixth starter to point to and say, all right, now it's your turn because we got to send the rookie down to get a little more seasoning. But that was the game the Phillies chose to play, and that was the outcome. And I think that was generally disappointing, but I feel like most people would agree that, when you're starting a game with Tim Mays as the opener and Alan Ranhel's pitching the middle chunk, there's a chance you're not going to win that game. But like you said, that wasn't even the real driving reason for why the Phillies lost. They just, couldn't score and couldn't hit off Foster Griffin. And, that happens too. Fortunately, it didn't happen for the next three games. Because in game two, that framing that the Nationals are like, oh, okay, well, now we got to win against the Phillies. Now we really are the same as the Phillies. Like, we can do it.
We beat them for one game. Let's go.
boy, oh boy, did they think the Phillies had, did they think they had the Phillies beat in the next two games? And, you know, objectively, why wouldn't they think that? It would be insane to think that this would happen, let alone twice. By the fourth inning, I do think they had resigned to perhaps never beating the Phillies again. But it all began in game two. Jesus Luzardo gets bashed for five runs, but strikes out a career high and a season high for any Phillies pitcher, 13 strikeouts.
Good Lord, what a weird guy.
Just the kind of guy we're going to get, apparently. It reminds me of a guy just like, you're driving down the highway and there's just a guy swinging a big sword back and forth. And you're like, I don't know what's going on in his mind, but he's taking some mighty hacks. And honestly, he's pretty good with a sword, like honestly, objectively.
Maybe there'll be a dragon here. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. Phils go down 5-0 in game two. The Nationals are really feeling themselves at this point. But Phils tied back up with, in this game's hero, one of this game's heroes. This was really was a collective effort. There's different names you're talking about across the board.
There was no Schwarber in the first two games. And they went to town. And I was like, God, that's, what a shot in the arm.
Yeah. Now the Phils tied back up with Edmundo Sosa, who had a two-run shot and legged out a fielder's choice to ensure a run scored all by himself. That made it 5-3. JT Realmuto then tied the game with a two-run double, and then when Orion Kerkering gave the lead right back, well, that's when a lot of people turned the game off, and I know that for sure because I received many messages from people saying I'm turning the game off because the Phillies gave the lead right back, and it just felt like after the loss in game one, after going down 5-0, you know, I could see why people start, your brain starts looking at it from the perspective of like, oh, this is a series where they're going to blow it, but anyone who turned off the game, which, again, I'm not shaming you for doing, because I understand that perspective. But never. They did miss the win of the season when another Brandon Marsh home run. He's got 7 this month, the most he's ever had in a single month. Bryson Stott's 3-run homer and an RBI from Trey Turner. And then you guessed it, Edmundo Sosa. He had another one as well. Gave the Phillies a 14-9 victory. They scored 8 runs after they'd been down to their last strike in the ninth. Liz, just has to be the win of the season.
It was, I mean, seriously, it was that one game. I know a couple of years ago there was a series where they did this kind of thing. They came back late in the game, like for 2 or 3 straight games right before the All-Star break. And
okay, I'm not. I don't mean to interrupt you, but somebody brought this up that they couldn't remember a series like this before either. And I think you might be talking about the one I thought of, which was back in 2012 when I think they beat the Brewers 3 times in a row by the score of 7-6 each time, but each one was a comeback victory. And that was like the only time that season that you were like, oh, maybe this is it. Maybe they clicked back in. Maybe like this team's going to figure it out. They, of course, did not. But that series popped into my head when people were talking about what is this even compared to. Sorry.
What? It was that long ago. Jeez. That's what, 14 years ago?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I'm just like, this definitely happened in the last few years. Bryce Harper was certainly there. Nope. Not even close. What was I talking about?
Sorry, you were talking about
looking at my own mortality.
When the Phillies had done things like this previously.
Oh, yes. I mean, that one game definitely felt like a callback to a time that I know was a long time ago, like 8-9, a little bit of 10. I know that's when it felt to be like they cannot lose. If they're down late and they've got the right guys up, they'll win always. And that felt like that first win against the Nationals really felt like that. It didn't feel like we were about to start a trend.
No.
But it felt really good. And I said, I bet this helps the Phillies feel really good after the previous day's incredibly frustrating loss. One-run losses like that have got to be frustrating.
Yeah, and one of the best things about wins like this is how much you are getting in your opponent's head. And even by the end of game 4, the Phillies broadcast was saying, like, repeatedly, they know what they're looking at in this Nationals bullpen. Like, this is all very purposeful. They want to get in there. They want to face these guys because they know they can beat them. And the Nationals just have to stand there and be like, well, maybe they won't. And that's just not what happened because they have a really bad bullpen. They did not invest in pitching, and it's really clear. As it was the following night in game 3, which was exactly when nobody thought the Phillies could do that again. Well, Aaron Nola got the start, And he was gone after five innings and I think about 86 pitches. Fransky said on the radio that the Phillies don't seem to be super into letting Nola pitch deep into games, even though he himself would, of course, like to. But this seems to be, I don't know, a little more...
$1 million, man.
A little more careful of an approach. I mean, he didn't make his worst start of the season. He never really seems to make his worst start of the season. We don't have to... We all know what the deal is with Aaron Nola.
We're going to do this again.
Yeah, it's never so bad. Like, for a long time, it's more like several key moments are very bad. And that's what happens when you're a starting pitcher whose fatal flaw is giving up home runs. But like I said, wasn't his worst start. He did allow home runs. And in Don Mattingly's world, in which the bullpen management is kind of questionable and the offense totally works, apparently, Aaron Nola gets five frames and then sits down. I'm not going to argue with that right now, especially since, you know, how this game ended.
You know what happens when he goes six.
Exactly. We haven't even mentioned, and you brought it up, but I hadn't mentioned Kyle Schwarber. He came into this series, he was having lower back problems. He sat out game one. He was relegated to the bench in game two, which was good because he got to come out in the ninth as a pinch hitter with the Phillies down a run. I'm sorry, game three, with the Phillies down a run. Bryson Stott, JT Realmuto, and Gabriel Rincones Jr. knocked in some early runs, but the Nationals' Curtis Meade gave them their lead back with a homer that made it 4-3. Curtis Meade, the Phillies farmhand traded to Tampa for Christopher Sanchez, went a little nuts in this series. He had three hits, but they were all homers, and he knocked in five runs over four games. He also, I believe, made some nifty defensive moves out there. Kept hearing Curtis Meade's name. Could have been a narrative had this series gone another way. Well, Schwarber came up with two outs in the ninth. He worked an epic 10-pitch at bat and walked to first. Pinch hitter Derek Hill came up next, and the Nationals bullpen did its thing. Hill whacked a two-run homer to right with two outs and two strikes, and the Phillies once more stole a win from these Nationals, who really think of themselves as contenders but really don't want to pay for a pitching staff. The Phillies won 5-4, officially, I would say, lodged in the Nationals' head at this point, because then you get to last night in Game 4. Well, if you had any doubts that they would do it again, you were made to feel the fool. Down 5-0 yet again after another soft start, this time by Christopher Sanchez, who is probably not going to win the NL Cy Young at this point. Doesn't mean it won't be a great season, but he's not putting up the, like, as Jacob Mizorowski only continues to ascend, Christopher Sanchez is kind of, you know, letting in runs. So that's the kind of thing Cy Young voters tend to notice. A section of Nationals fans were chanting at Harper, or as Fransky put it, serenading him. After he hit a second deck homer, he gave them a little hand gesture as he rounded second. As he said, obviously just the ring finger. Make sure that's out there, he told the press. On the one hand, obviously, you know, a retort to that would be, that's a pretty empty looking ring finger you got there, Bryce Harper. But I'm not on that side. I'm on this one. And I like personal and surgical, how personal and surgical Bryce can make a moment like that. It's an Ashburnian quality to him, you know, like the idea of somebody hitting a foul ball at a heckler. He's not afraid to let you know he can hear you. He just wants to beat you before he responds. And I also think that's great juice for him with this energy he's unlocked in the past few days, past two series. This series, Liz, was, I think, really good for Bryce Harper in particular.
Oh, completely. I don't think there could be anything better for him than for him to come to Washington, place where he grew up as a baseball player, where they now hate him for leaving when the Nationals did not offer him a comparable contract, which is their fault and not his. Let's not forget that, but they hate him. It's their prerogative. And for him to come in and just not even give them a thought as being a real competitor to them. At no point did he look like, this is hard. Like, he didn't get a hit in every at-bat, but he looked so confident. Like, I think he would rather hear jeers than cheers sometimes, depending on his mood. He would rather hear people, like, booing or cheering directly against him. Because you're right, it feeds him in a way that I don't think he wants to admit. He really responds to the negativity. And I wish he would recognize that and sort of try to play into it more, because I don't think he mentally gets there unless it's something like the Nationals where he feels personally slighted.
Yep, I think if Bryce Harper hears his own fans booing, I mean, he'll give you like, oh, he'll typically give you like, I understand what they're thinking, kind of, you know, response because he just knows to do that. But hearing his own fans booing, or as we saw, like, you know, even the trade rumor stuff that was back in the winter that was never anything close to real, like, that stuff gets to him in a bad way. But, like, getting cheered by his fans, you know, stepping coming through in that big moment, we all know that's Bryce Harper. But also, if he's on the road and the other fans aren't booing, I think he kind of thinks, I'm not doing my job if the other fans aren't furious with me, especially in Washington, where he very famously has done very well since leaving the Nationals. In 2019 alone, his first season back there, he hit .344 at Nationals Park in 40 plate appearances just in that season. But, like, that was kind of a message that, yeah, I think he gets a little extra juice playing in Washington. He just does. So the Phillies are down 5-0 until the 6th in Game 4 when, hey, what's this? Another Brandon Marsh home run gets them on the board.
I could not believe it. Like, every time he was up, I definitely stopped whatever I was doing and looked, because I'm like, every Brandon Marsh at bat now is something I want to watch. Every single one. Because there's a better chance than not that he'll do something good.
I think now might be the time to reinvigorate my efforts to get the Swamp Thing nickname trending again. Everyone,
I don't think there's a word. This is the best time. Swamp Thing. He's the king. It doesn't. I mean, Schwarber's the home run king of the team, but I mean, he's the engine. He's the king of non-home runs, even home runs. The guy cannot stop hitting. Swamp Thing is perfect. Everyone, we should do this. You need to be on Blue Sky more to give this more oomph. That's the problem. It's not catching on because you are not trying.
I was really discouraged by I tried once and failed and then didn't go back to it. If I was 20 years younger, I'd probably buy a full Swamp Thing costume, put a Brandon Marsh jersey over it, and then go to the All-Star game, which presumably he will be playing in. We'll get to that in a minute. So he gets the Phillies on the board, 5-2. I'm also working on Gabriel Rincones Jr.'s nickname being the Archangel, but he needs to hit more home runs for that to work. In the 7th inning, the Phillies mounted the kind of rally that indicates the other team just doesn't want to win the game. Justin Crawford and Trey Turner both singled, but then Washington just started walking everybody, presumably in the stadium.
I was just like, you... Where's the strike zone? Is it?
Yeah.
It was right there, and they couldn't find it. I'm just like, I'm yelling at the Phillies players, you know, from my seat, like, don't swing here. He's definitely don't swing here. And they were not swinging. I was
they
surprised.
Didn't.
I'm like, I
that's crazy. They never do that. And when Alec Bohm came up, and the guy before him had walked, and Bohm came up, and he threw like 6 straight balls, and you're like, absolutely, just keep letting them pit. Like, if they're going to do that, let them pit. We've said it to the TV so many times, and finally the Nationals were doing it so blatantly that even the Phillies learned to stop swinging. Richard Lovelady is a name you heard a couple of times coming out of the Nationals bullpen. He did fine enough in Game 1, but boy, he did not have what I would call a great series out of the Nationals pen, and he's one of several guys who you could say that about. Clayton Beater is another one who was not coming through. But Lovelady walked 2 guys and was still throwing pitches 2 feet out of the zone after several runs had come in via the bases-loaded walk. The only question really became, okay, who's going to win it for the Phillies at that point? Once they tied it up, it was just like they're going to win this game. So those guys shouting at Bryce had gone home at this point, by the way. They weren't shouting anymore. The answer to who the hero was going to be was, of course, everyone. But, appropriately, mostly Bryce. Boy, he wanted to be the one a couple of times in this series. And he was a couple of times. But there are other times when he just wanted it and it didn't happen.
Swinging out of his sneakers.
In the 9th, Bryce went opposite field with a 2-run blast off Gus Varland of the Nationals to give the Phillies a 7-5 lead. And see, this is where a lot of comebacks would stop. You know, that's because that's enough. You even got an insurance run there. That's probably where, you know, a lot of comebacks just sort of like, all right, we got it. Brandon Marsh, best baseball player on planet Earth, singled and stole second after that. Then he came in to score on JT Realmuto's double.
Hey, and JT then did something.
Derek Hill, or Derek Kills, as I'm getting that started as well. Derek Kills, doing way better, getting way more traction, which, again, I think proves your point about being on Blue Sky because, yeah, that's definitely playing well there. He came up again and just crushed another home run to make it 10-5. The Phillies scored 10 unanswered runs in this baseball game.
It's ridiculous. I had to leave the game mercy of the Maryland public transit system. The last MARC train is at 10:15, so I had, it takes like 45 minutes to get all the way out there. So I had to leave early, and my sister, who does not listen to the podcast, I'm going to mention that every episode until she does. She doesn't listen to podcasts. She obviously doesn't love me. But I got text messages from my dad and my sister like, holy crap, they did it again. I'm like, of course. Because when I came, I realized, all right, this is definitely going to be a bad Christopher Sanchez start because I am here. And it was. He gave up a home run before I walked in. And after that, the rest of the runs scored. That was unpleasant. Yeah. Now I forgot what I was talking about because I got angry at my sister.
Well, hey, it's a good series like that'll scramble your brain. So that's completely understandable. Chase Shugart, Orion Kerkering, Jose Alvarado, and Tim Meza, all of whom had moments that made your forehead wrinkle over these four games, combined to pitch four shutout innings and allowed only one hit combined with no walks, striking out six to close out game four. So Phillies wrap that one up 110-5, and this series is over. 3 out of 4 in Washington. The game they lost was a bullpen game, and the Phillies' offense was unrelenting and at its most dramatic and clutch. This feels like the team, honestly, you know, regardless of who they're beating, how they're winning, how they won in this series, really feels like a good team finding another gear, Liz. And boy, there may not be a better time to do this because the Braves have looked more vulnerable than they have all season lately. I believe they recently lost 3 in a row. I actually don't know how they did last night, but they clearly, like, you know, a team that looked impenetrable for the longest time.
They lost 4 in a row now.
The Phillies are 4 games behind the Braves in the National League East. I've been saying that the division's off the table. I mean, it's not. That's 4. That's a 4-game. The Phillies have won 7 of their last 10. The Braves have lost 7 of their last 10.
That's how you do it, ladies and gentlemen.
The landscape is shifting in the National League East, and we're watching it happen. And it's not even July, so you're not even really talking about the All-Star break in full yet. Even if we are going to talk about the All-Stars, just to put a pin or just to close the loop on this series, MLB.com says the Phillies are the first team in Major League history to hit a go-ahead home run in the 9th inning of 3 consecutive games, according to the Elias Sports Bureau.
That's awesome.
Making history.
Oh, I do want to mention real briefly the shirtless boy men up in the right field stands. The guys behind me were really confused, and I had to tell them that it's part of like a trend of young white men, definitely white, going up to the right field, wherever the upper deck in the stadium, taking off their shirts and waving them over their heads, just spinning them over their heads. And I mean, the article you read to start the podcast mentioned that they yelled USA. That was not what they were really doing. They were mostly just yelling. They were just doing the Seven Nation Army chant over and over. And then they got bored with that and started yelling USA. And then they'd get bored with that and go back. It's a trend that's been popping up in a bunch of stadiums, and it's real weird. That's all I have to say about that. But it started with like 6 dudes up in the corner. And then it just started. It's like a magnet or like a dinner bell or something. As soon as those guys started making noise up there, other young dudes started going up and joining them. Eventually, they filled the entire section.
Yeah, I've seen this. This has happened in major. I believe they would credit it as having started in St. Louis, I believe. Yeah. But this is the kind of thing that someone will, if we're wrong about that, someone will race to correct us, because if a team like the Rockies started it, they're going to want credit, you know, because what else do they have? And that's perfectly understandable, to be honest. But yeah, it is sweeping the nation, the Tarps Off movement. And all I know about it is what you described. Bunch of guys kind of slowly fill a section and take their shirts off. Fully support it. Everybody's having a good time. It feels like it's a good way for fans to have fun, even in a stadium where the team's not very good. So I'm all for that.
It was really amusing. I mean, as far as I knew, everyone found it funny. The dudes behind me were like, why won't the stadium camera show them? Show them! Come on! You suck! And I'm like, who are you yelling at?
And they were certainly picking up the audio in a couple of cases, as we mentioned. I think it's the confluence of, you know, it's baseball season. It's also Fleet Week down in Washington. So you got a lot of that stuff going on. And also the World Cup. You know, I think that's where a lot of the Seven Nation Army stuff comes from. The Mets game the other day against the Cubs. We're going to talk a little bit about the Mets in a bit here. That series saw entire sections filling with Norwegian soccer fans who were just there for a good time. And they made so much noise. I don't know if they really knew who they were like rooting for, if they were just kind of rooting for fun baseball moments in general, but they were doing like different coordinated moves,
stuff.
Yeah, it was, and that's cool. That's cool to see. I'm sure, you know, Mets fans are, if I was having a lousy season like the Mets are having and a bunch of jubilant people came into the stadium, I don't know if I'd be like as good-spirited about it, but whatever. The point is, like, that's the kind of thing that's going on right now, and it is cool to see in a general sense, but fortunately, the Phillies' joy and happiness is not connected to simply what's happening in their stadium. Their level of play is also quite exciting, unlike with the Nationals and the Mets. Speaking of which, the All-Star finalists were announced. Have you seen the results of Phase 1 of voting, Liz? This is going to surprise you, I think. So Phase 1 of All-Star voting is over. The system as it exists now is designed to prevent ballot stuffing, if you had any confusion about this. There's Phase 1 and Phase 2 of voting. There's Phase 1 of voting where everybody can vote for anybody, position player-wise. Then, in Phase 2, you cut it down to the two top vote-getters at each position, except the outfield, you get six top vote-getters, because obviously there's three outfield spots. So, then you're just voting between those people. So that way, you know, if one of the Dodgers isn't in the top two, Dodgers fans can't stuff the ballot to get an undeserving Dodgers player in, which is, I think, this year probably the biggest concern on that front. So who from the Phillies made it to Phase 2, Liz? Bryce Harper didn't make it. Bryce Harper's not one of the two finalists at first base. Neither is Kyle Schwarber. Here's the thing. Good Fight commenter named Martin861 kind of laid this out. I'm just going to read verbatim what they said. The overall top vote getter in each league is also an all-star without the second round of voting. In the National League, who do you think that is? Shohei Ohtani.
Oh, yeah.
No. Shohei Ohtani, who is designated as a designated hitter. So there is no ballot in the second part of voting for the DH, and therefore you cannot vote for Kyle Schwarber. That doesn't mean he won't be on the team. The manager gets to fill out the bench, and if he looks at the MLB home run leader and ignores him, that'll be insane. Kyle Schwarber will be there.
You have to have not watched last year's.
You're right.
Exactly. You would have to have completely been under a rock or in a cave to not watch last year's. Like, Kyle Schwarber is like the first guy you put on in the bench. There's no question.
You ever seen a man win a baseball game MVP award without having a position or an at-bat? Because I have, and his name's Kyle Schwarber.
His name's Kyle Schwarber, and it's the coolest thing that ever happened.
But the Phillies you can still vote for are Brandon Marsh and two others. Who else do you think? If it's not Bryce Harper and it's not Kyle Schwarber, who are the two other Phillies other than Brandon Marsh who you can vote for in All-Star voting?
I think one of them's got to be Bryson Stott, because when I looked at the results like a week ago or whenever it was, he was like second. He was like really up there, and it's because I don't think there are a lot of good or memorable second basemen in the National League, and Bryson Stott is very cute.
You are correct. It is a thin market. At second base in the National League is a thin market. You will be able to vote for Bryson Stott or Ozzie Albies of the Braves to start as the National League second baseman. Liz, what if Bryson Stott is the starting second baseman at the All-Star game? I did not plan or think this at all.
I don't know. The All-Star, I mean, one thing we all know is that the All-Star game is complete nonsense. It's just whatever happens is what happens. There's no rule or rhyme or reason to it. Just period.
To be clear, Bryson Stott in 261 at-bats in 2026 is hitting .238. With a .694 OPS. I have no personal problems with Bryson Stott. I like Bryson Stott. Those aren't all-star numbers. But hey, maybe he'll be in the all-star game.
The fans, what would they want?
Yeah, I'm perfectly supportive of it. Let's see it. And you know what? He could make a play in an all-star game defensively. He'd get a big hit too, obviously. But as a stellar defensive player, he could make a diving stop that, you know, it's not like he's going to not look like an all-star. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Who do you think the other one is? Not a lot of options.
No. All right, so we can eliminate the rest of the outfield.
It's not an outfielder, it's not a first baseman, and it's not a second baseman. Kind of leaves you with, I guess, three infield options.
I'm going to have to say Alec Bohm. He's the only one I can imagine.
Alec Bohm is your other option to vote in the All-Star game. You can choose between Alec Bohm or Max Muncy of the Dodgers at third. Also, kind of, I don't think Muncy's having the best year either. I think this is also another kind of low decision, at least as far as the voters indicated. Let me see. Max Muncy is... That's the different. I forgot. There's two Max Muncies now. There's a Max Muncy on the A's.
Not true. You're making that up.
No, it's true. There's another guy named Max Muncy, and he's on the A's. Yeah.
Is that possible?
The 35-year-old Max Muncy on the Dodgers is hitting .266 with an .873 OPS. Solid year for sure. But just kind of another middling year for National League third baseman as well. So you got to choose between Muncy and Bohm at third base. Liz, there could be a bunch of all-stars from the Phillies in this game, more than I think we really predicted. And I don't know why. I just kind of feel like, I mean, is Bryce Harper really not going to have a role in some way or another, like at the Phillies-hosted all-star game, even if that winds up being the thing that kind of like pushes it over the edge? I don't know. Just seems crazy that he wouldn't be there for a All-Star game in Philadelphia while he's with the team and like playing well.
He'll be there. I don't know what, like, regardless of whether or not he's voted onto the team or chosen for the team, he'll be there. He'll be doing something. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like he could, I don't know. I think he might do the home run derby. I think he'd have fun with that.
Oh, if he doesn't make the team, him doing that that'd be interesting. Yeah.
That's got to be it. Because if Schwarber makes the team, he won't want to do the derby. And I don't think he wants to mess with the swing too much. And so I think Harper would be,
he could also be selected in the same way that Schwarber will presumably be selected. So
yeah. I'm mostly just trying to describe, like, him in the home run derby in Philadelphia, how incredible that would be. And I think now that I've said all this out loud, that's exactly what's going to happen. Because if he doesn't make the team, he doesn't make the team. And I think he'll want something. If he's not a starter, I think he'll probably want something where he can be looked at individually, which is what he definitely wants, I think, for, you know, the All-Star game. That's what it's about.
Yeah.
So I think he would, I think he's definitely in for the derby.
The fact that he's not playing poorly at all and that the game is in Philadelphia, I do think gives him a little bonus push of some kind. But honestly, who knows how the voting works at this point, how the selection processes work and everything. And also, you have who's going to be hurt by then, who's going to opt out to play. Even the names I'm about to read, the ones that Brandon Marsh is up against, the five other outfielders, are Andy Pajes of the Dodgers, Ronald Acuna Jr. of the Braves. He's had injuries this year. Teoscar Hernandez of the Dodgers, pretty sure he's been hurt this year. Juan Soto of the Mets, I believe he's currently hurt very recently. Yeah, Michael Harris II of the Braves is the other one. So, you know, honestly, if Marsh doesn't make this All-Star game, I'm going to lose my mind.
He's made the All-Star game. Let's just be clear. He's made the All-Star game now. Like, he's one of the six. And with those six to choose from, who's the most fun to watch right now?
Yeah,
like,
I mean,
why do you think like Stott and Bohm are getting votes? Mm-hmm. Because the Phillies lately have been doing well, and those two players have been doing well, and they've been highlighted because they're doing better.
Yeah. Like we said, this National Series had no shortage of heroes, and, you know, Bryson Stott had a 3-run home run that won them that one game. So, like, these are guys who you're not able to point at them currently. And these are the guys I think you've been able to point to and say, like, oh, those guys aren't hitting as well as we want. Oh, that, you know, they were doing a little better, but then they fell off again. When those guys aren't struggling, then the success of the team is, you know, it's going to be more enjoyable and they're going to be less scrutinized for any of their shortcomings. And lately, their shortcomings haven't been super on display. Who's going to come out of this series and not want to vote for a Phillies player? Like, this was the great time to have a series like this where they not only won, but they also looked particularly heroic while they're doing it. And now everybody feels really good about the Phillies and they'll vote for any Philly. That's just wild to me that we're talking about Bohm and Stott, who statistically are not like what you would think of as an all-star, as much as I, you know, will support them being there. It's just objectively true. But hey, you know, The more the merrier, as far as this All-Star game in particular goes.
But that, we haven't thought that the fact that it's in Philadelphia could be why they're getting more votes.
Sure. I don't mind that at all. I think the Phillies should be overrepresented. You know, we did this 30 years ago, and they had one guy. Which, by the way, if you want to hear about the 1996 season, which again, John Stolness called the darkest of his entire life, we're going to talk about the 1996 season leading up to the All-Star game on The Dirty Inning. Very soon, in the month of July, that'll be our first episode before the All-Star game as part of our All-Star celebration.
Of his entire life.
Yeah. So, you'll have that to look forward to. So, why don't we overcorrect with the 2026 Phillies All-Star game? It'll be 30 years before it's back here again, and who knows what that's going to look like. So, yeah, let's go nuts. Bryson Stott and Alec Bohm, full-time All-Stars, absolutely. But who's not filling out the ballot with a ton of representation is the New York Metropolitans, Elizabeth, who the Phillies will face this weekend up at Citi Field in New York. Well, it's finally time to play the Mets again. When's the last time you checked in with the New York Mets, Elizabeth? Because I think things have probably gotten worse since maybe even the beginning of this sentence.
They might have, because the last time I checked on them was yesterday when I was just clicking around and co-working with my colleague at Sabre, Cecilia Tan. I was just scrolling and there was a headline that said Mets man, you know, Carlos Mendoza, you know, says words about, you know, players who are struggling. And I stopped and said to her, Carlos Mendoza is still the manager of the Mets?
They made a choice.
Maybe 22 hours ago, 21 hours ago, I said that to her. And she's like, yeah, he made it through. And I'm like, I can't believe that. I can't believe he wasn't fired. And I log on this morning and it says Carlos Mendoza dismissed. And I'm like, I am right there. I'm right there. I knew it was coming. Come on.
Yes, 37 minutes ago, ESPN published a story on the Mets firing manager Carlos Mendoza, which, Elizabeth, I'm going to be honest with you, you just broke that news to me that Carlos Mendoza was fired.
Oh, really?
This podcast started recording 41 minutes ago. This news was published 37 minutes ago. I didn't even see that. I didn't even have that in my notes that I was about to read. So things are moving quickly as far as the Mets plummeting out of relevance in 2026. I had these notes that the Mets had committed 6 errors in a recent game against the Cubs. This from a team that was outspoken in their focus on infield defense and run prevention coming into the 2026 season. I'll go back to what David Stern said last winter, who built this Mets roster, when he said they would be focusing on improving their defense. Run prevention is where we fell short last year. Mets president of baseball operations David Stern said during a press conference at the end of the 2025 season, it's where we need to get better. And he doubled down on that sentiment, saying competitors had told him, your defense wasn't close to good enough last year. Now, as we know, the Mets blew up their core from the last few years. Pete Alonso is not back. Jeff McNeil was sent away. Brandon Nimmo was traded to the Texas Rangers. So, you know, that was a choice they made. And we said going into this season, the Mets chose to blow up their core. The Phillies chose to stuck with theirs. We shall see who was right. They both started pretty lousy. And so that argument kind of went out the window. And then it became an argument of, okay, well, one of them, after a frustrating start, chose to fire their manager, and one of them chose to stick with their manager. That narrative is now out the window as well. So you can't even say that was the differentiating point. You could say that, yeah, in the time that the Mets did not fire Mendoza, looking in that window, the Phillies thrived, the Mets did not. So that argument, I guess you could say, was concluded. But the Mets are now 13 games under 500 and in last place in the National League East. They got Francisco Lindor back from injury, but just in time for Marcus Semien to head to the injured list. They've started chanting for Pete Alonso at Mets games, sort of like he's just a lost golden retriever at the park and they're just kind of like looking for him somewhere.
Well, no, that was when they were facing the Orioles, which is where he is.
No, they were chanting it when they were playing the Cubs.
Oh, really? Because I saw that from the Orioles, and I'm just like, wow. And that makes no sense.
They just want him back. Like I said, they're like calling out. It's like they have a leash in their hand, and they're just calling out for a lost golden retriever. Because he's like playing in a duck pond at the other end of the park, and they're just like, Pete, come back, please. And while we were all sleeping, this was the big one I thought I was going to be talking about. While we were all sleeping, they traded David Peterson to the Cubs.
Yep.
But apparently they also fired Carlos Mendoza before we started recording. Well, according to MLB Trade Rumor, the Mets probably aren't ready for a complete fire sale. I disagree. But there's more difficult than ever to convince themselves they'll turn things around. Peterson was a logical option to be one of the first players to move. He's an impending free agent who has pitched his way out of the rotation a couple of times this season. Peterson returned to the starting five over the weekend, but gave up five runs. They said across four innings and a loss to Philadelphia, but that's not correct.
That
I think they were thinking ahead to this weekend when they'll be playing the Phillies. Yeah. Laura Albanese covers the Mets for Newsday, and she wrote, "It's more than the fact that the Mets traded a scuffling Peterson to the Cubs for infield prospect Cole Mathis. Because consider this. When asked about his trade deadline strategy on Tuesday, David Stern said he planned to continue to give this team time to prove that we can get back in this in a very legitimate sense. The cutoff is the deadline," he said. That may have been true at the time, but it certainly didn't feel true in the ensuing hours. First, a 9-6 loss to the Cubs that saw Juan Soto go down with a back injury that still might land him on the injured list. And then a split doubleheader Wednesday that proved to be little more than a prolonged humiliation ritual. And that's when they moved Peterson. Sure, Peterson hadn't been what you would call good. He has a 6.09 ERA, but fared better when the Mets used an opener ahead of him. But he certainly was what you would call a warm body. And given Kodai Senga's implosion and subsequent bullpen banishment, that alone qualifies you to start for the Mets these days. And that might mean that the full fire sale is nigh. It also means that for 2 years in a row, the Mets will have been the worst team that money can buy. Halfway point through the season, 81 games in. We are already 81 games into this Major League Baseball season. The Mets are 34-47. Liz, even before these three games, I mean, let's imagine a situation where the Mets do a complete reversal on the Phillies and like they beat the Phillies in three games in the same way that the Phillies just beat the Nationals. Like not just a sweep, but a feel good sweep. Do you think that would even be enough to turn this? Like the narrative would be, well, the Mets might be turning their season around, but they've already started trading players. They fired their manager. I mean, are you willing to say the Mets are done regardless of what happens in this series, or it's still June and it's still, you know, you never know.
It's still June and you never know, because we've seen that with the Phillies. We've all been like, the division isn't even a possibility, but now they're just four games out and there's still another 81 games to play. So we don't know what's going to happen with the Mets, but it certainly seems bad. It certainly doesn't. No good portent for the future. Things do not look great going forward, you know? I mean, the Phillies fired their manager too, but one thing they didn't do is trade an important player. Regardless of how David Peterson, was playing, he was still an important player to the Mets. You know, even if he pitched himself out of the rotation, he was still important, and they traded him overnight to the Cubs. And so this feels definitely more dire, especially given the injuries and just the bad vibes. I mean, the Phillies, one thing they've done, you know, two bad season starts now, is figure out how to shake things up. And it was extreme both times. They fired Joe Girardi, they fired Rob Thompson, but it worked. And who knows if it'll work a third time. Let's hope we don't have to try. But you know, that has worked for them now. And just the Mets are a mess, man. Everyone thought that after, you know, the richest man in the universe bought them, that things would be perfect. And it's like just as bad, if not now worse, because they spent a lot of money and built up hopes only to suck. And everyone's so sad and angry about it.
The difference in firing your manager when you are 9-19 is that you get a whole, 53 games extra?
Before you hit, yep.
Whereas the Mets waiting till now, you know, any kind of change this is going to do, okay, it could very well, who knows, maybe it has a Phillies-esque change, the way the Phillies seem to thrive when their last two managers were swapped out. Maybe it does, but you are now, you know, that's 53 games you could have been benefiting from that you weren't. And the Phillies were. And they are 36-17 in those games. So you never know if it's going to work, but there's a chance that it does. And if that's the move you want to make, then making it now and letting it pay off, giving it more time to pay off, well, the Phillies are seeing the benefits of that. One more win and the Phillies are 10 games over 500. That is not a place it was easy to imagine them being when they were 9-19 and Rob Thompson was being fired. But that was early enough that I think you'll look back and see, you know, if current trends continue, then the Phillies, they did the right thing, despite us saying we didn't feel like Rob Thompson was the problem. Well, you don't have to be the problem to be the solution in this sense. As Jim Salisbury kept phrasing it, a shock to the system like that can have an impact on a locker room, even if Rob Thompson isn't the main reason you're losing games. And there's plenty of arguments to be made that the way Rob Thompson managed was perhaps the reason, a reason that was contributing to losses. You can certainly make that argument as well. But regardless, the Phillies are seeing the benefits of making a change like that when they made it. The Mets, we'll see. But they are in a deeper hole much later into the season than the Phillies were when they decided to make that same change. And only time will tell, but we are halfway through the season. Well, before we wrap things up here, Liz, I do want to talk about Major League Baseball owners' latest proposal as negotiations, CBA negotiations or pre-negotiations or however this is phrased, continue. We are at the fun part of this in which everyone is submitting proposals that they know the other side will not like. And it's all a bit of theater, I think it's fair to say at this point. You're seeing a lot of things.
It's all MLB right now and their propaganda machine. The PA isn't releasing anything.
Right. The PA or the owners submitted a proposal that focused on earlier access to free agency, increase to the minimum salary, pre-arbitration bonus pool increase, an elimination of the qualifying offer system, and a method that would make it easier for them to retain superstars. MLB.com says that the proposal includes any team signing a free agent from another club would be restricted to a contract that covers a maximum of 5 seasons and a maximum first year salary of 15% of the cap. Also, the MLBPA responded, and the first part of their response to this proposal is, after making a series of proposals to reduce player compensation by billions of dollars, eliminate fundamental rights with a salary cap, and destroy the amateur entry process, you can see how the framing of these issues differs depending on who is talking about them. Yes. Major League Baseball and team owners are now attempting to distract from the true impact their plan would have on baseball. These misleading offers are designed to look like improvements, but are of little or no value, given that they are expressly conditioned on agreement to the league's cap system, which eliminates the free market and ensures gains for one player only come at the expense of another. There's more to that response as well. But Liz, please explain for us non-scholars what this most recent proposal was in terms of the overall picture of the CBA negotiation.
The important thing to remember in public CBA negotiations like this is that it's all about propaganda. And MLB is starting hot. They had their main account yesterday, you know, on X, I'm just going to say tweet out a whole bunch of stuff. And it was all purely propaganda, and people on X didn't buy it, which was nice. But that's what it's about right now. It's about propaganda and trying to get the public on your side. MLB, they did really well with that up until the last CBA, when social media was really, when that really became a major part of convincing the public whose side, you know, they should be on. And so, like, MLB is pounding the pavement right now, sending out ideas to scare the PA. And when you hear proposals at this stage, it's important to remember that these are their very first public offers. We don't know if there's been anything offered privately, but this is their very first public offer. Now, what you do when you offer to begin with, you put your ideal on paper. This is what we want in the ideal world where we got everything we wanted. And, you know, that'll be the PA's strategy as well when they start releasing. But these proposals have no chance of happening. That's the most important thing to remember. The first proposals have next to no chance of making it to the end because they are so extreme. Because that's the point. You start at the extreme points of where you want to, of where you're eventually going to end up, because you have to compromise. And so if anyone's worried about this, don't be. because MLB is trying hard early, and it doesn't seem to be working. They're doing all the things right that they, you know, that anti-union shops do all the time. But it just, it's not, thus far, it doesn't seem to be working for them. Some people have begun to change their minds and see, it's a terrifying look into what major league owners want. They want to roll back all the labor gains that were made in the 70s. Like, what they're proposing, it appears to be better, but it's not. In all of their proposals, what they do is they show how much players would have made if this had been, you know, in the rules since, you know, the last CBA or whatever. And they say it's all this money. And that is, it's meant to confuse, because it has no bearing on what will be the future, because the future is going to be entirely different, especially if the owners get their way and there's a cap, which there won't be. I'm just going to say it. There won't be any cap. The PA will stay out forever to avoid a cap, because we can all see how it worked in other sports. Everybody loves free agency and signing time in the NBA and the NFL. It's always fun and pure. No, it's terrible because the caps are terrible. So at this point, don't worry, but be aware of what the owners want. They want a world in which labor plays no major part, and they can trade players and do whatever they want with them at any time. That's what they're looking for, and that's the system they had in early baseball, which was terrible and led to the creation of a bunch of different leagues to try and circumvent that. That won't happen this time, but it's still bad.
Well, the owners will keep submitting ideas they know won't work, and the Players Association will continue releasing statements saying that doesn't work until the actual negotiations are underway. But Liz, the phrase "don't worry, but be aware," that just sounds like that would appear on like a Players Association poster about the CBA negotiations. That's in general the only thing people can do at this point, and we get to follow along as baseball begins to sort itself out in the most unpleasant of ways. Gosh, I can't wait till this is the only news there is to talk about in baseball.
Enjoy baseball now, folks. Enjoy it.
And speaking of which, I want to close up by talking about one player in particular. No, he did not play in the four-game series. We just watched the Phillies beat the Washington Nationals. But he was, in fact, playing this past week, and that is my father, who was playing in an international softball tournament, went 10 for 14 with two walks, made a highlight reel play by getting the out at first while playing first and then whipping the ball home so they could get a runner trying to score. He was one of 15 players named to the tournament All-Star team. And oh yeah, when a comebacker made an opposing pitcher bleed from his forehead, my dad was out of that dugout and wrapping this man's head in gauze before all of his brains could fully fall out. Hat tip to the man who at this point must realize he's still a better athlete than I was or ever will be in what you could, I guess, call my prime. Just had to mention that. What an outstanding performance from my father in this softball tournament.
Cool. Oh my God, Justin, that is really cool. Your father is awesome.
He's a hero. He's a hero.
Both on the field and medically. Just outstanding. What a man.
Well, that'll do it for this episode of Hittin' Season. My thanks to my co-host, Liz Rocher. You can get new episodes of Hittin' Season anywhere you get your podcasts 3 times a week. You can also find bonus Phillies podcasts at the Hittin' Season Patreon at patreon.com/hittin'season. As I said, we'll have all kinds of all-star content coming up in the month of July over there at the Hittin' Season Patreon. I'm Justin Clue, and from WHYY, that's the ballgame. We'll talk to you next time on Hittin' Season.